Hi there, everyone. Are we on? Yes, I think we are. My name is Raphael Epstein from ABC Radio. Thank you, all of you, for coming. I want to thank the Wheeler Centre as well, Alan and Unwin, for inviting both me and Sammy Shah. This is the book, I Migrant, which I highly recommend, and I reckon we should give Sammy a round of applause. Because he's, for a young man, he's actually done some amazing, incredible things. Sammy, thanks for coming along.
Thank you for having me. Any excuse to come to Melbourne?
Yeah, good. Yeah. Well, it's nicer than being an hour and a half drive out of Perth, I assume, for
Everything
now.
Everything is.
No, surely there's nice things there. Look, I want to start with the toughest, most brutal part of your story,
of course,
if I can,
yeah.
Which is the bombing of Benazir Bhutto's convoy.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you set that up for me, though? Tell people what you're doing, what your job is
right.
at the time, and then, you know,
sure.
how you end up in, heading down there.
Does everyone know who Benazir Bhutto is, or was, rather? She'd been in exile for 8 years up until this point. This would be 2008, I think. And she'd been in exile because Pervez Musharraf had come in as the dictator general president of Pakistan. And it was self-imposed exile, so after 8 years, when it seemed very likely that Musharraf's government would fall, she decided to come back and try running in the elections again. And she has a huge, popular following in Pakistan, and she does to this day, even though she died several years ago now. And I was working as a news producer at the time for a TV channel in the country. And news producer's job is basically you're behind a control panel in the newsroom. You don't have to go out into the field and interact with other human beings. It's great because you just have computers and screens, and that's how I'm happiest. And but unfortunately, they needed every hand on deck when Benazir Bhutto was arriving, because there was over 1 million people in the streets there to greet her. And so they sent all the producers and reporters and everyone out, and I was there with a team of two cameramen and two reporters, and I was a producer on site at the airport where she was arriving, and her plane lands and she gets out, and we get all our footage of Benazir Bhutto, which gets broadcast to the nation, and then the convoy passes us, and we figure, all right, we're good now. Let's relocate to another place. And so that's when we started packing up and moving to another location while Benazir Bhutto had gone a few miles ahead, basically.
Tell us about the explosion.
What happened was that we packed up our things and we left to go to the other location when I got the phone call from my news producer, Azhar Abbas, who's the news director in Pakistan for our channel. And he called and said, look, there's been an explosion. Get back there. And so the van we were in made a U-turn and rushed back to where Benazir Bhutto was. We got there, I think, 8 minutes after the second explosion. What happened was she was on a bulletproof truck that had been converted into a caravan almost. And she'd been on the rooftop and waving to people. And then she went down inside the bulletproof truck to, you know, relax and recover for a while. When the first suicide bomber attacked the truck and blew up just outside it, the truck was damaged, but she survived. She got into she was hurried into an escape car, and that sped away. And that's when the second suicide bomber also attacked, and someone threw themselves into a police van and blew up the police van, basically. And the way they do it is they wear the jackets with ball bearings in them, and it's packed tight with ball bearings so that when the explosion happens, the ball bearings fly in every direction to maximize casualties. So when we got to the site, there'd been around 160, 170 people had just been killed on location in a very tightly packed area. And that's the site that confronted me when I got out of the van with the cameraman and saw the dead bodies and the human remains, if you will.
And that really vivid scene where you see, excuse me, I'm going to get a little bit grisly, but this is an important part of his story. I think you see that the man, he's dead, but his lungs are actually...
Yeah, that's the only thing I remembered for the longest time.
Yeah.
I did the Australian story 2 years ago when I came to Australia. I was interviewed by Australian Story, and the producer of the Australian Story, a wonderful lady named Belinda, she kept asking me, she's like, so what? Describe the scene that you saw. And I kept saying, oh, I don't remember anything, I don't remember anything, I don't remember anything. And she kept saying, like, are you sure you don't? Because you're saying that a lot. And that's when I realized, oh yeah, I've been saying that for like 5 years now, that I don't remember anything when I clearly do remember things and I'm not letting myself remember it. That was actually the first time I had that realization, which was a strange experience. And the one thing I do remember the most was I saw a man's lungs on fire, where the chest had been blown open and the lungs were visible. And they were baking hot like coals, and that was the one thing that to this day I can visualize. The rest of it's mostly a blur, but I definitely can see those.
I'm interested in what's going on in your mind and for an entire nation actually that encounters a horrific level of violence, because there's a few incidents in the book. I think it's an accountant from the TV station who is shot, and you have to deal with that.
Before the TV station, yes. I worked at a web design
company.
Sorry,
at the advertising. There's also another incident, though. There's any number of
incredible
violence.
There's no shortage of incredible acts of violence.
So what? Just give people an idea. What do you think is going on for someone in perhaps a city like Karachi or any major city? Is that just people in Pakistan just need to put those blinkers on to sort of deal with reality? What do you think is going on?
You can't put on blinkers because it's happening all the time and everywhere. You can't say, I'm not going to look at it because it's everywhere you look, right? But at the same time, I think, especially in Karachi with 22 million people, where suicide bombings aren't just the only thing that'll kill you. Like in Lahore, for example, which is one of the other big city in Pakistan, suicide bombings happen, but the other things don't. So like, you know, day-to-day crime is minimal and sectarian violence is minimal. In Karachi, it's a huge problem where there's many ways for you to die, not just one. And so what happens is people kind of realized a long time ago, you can either sit down and just start screaming, which is a very valid and human response, but you also have to do the groceries. And you can scream now and then do the groceries, or just suck it up and do the groceries. And I think that's the way people decide. Like, a lot of people outside of Karachi look at Karachi and say, oh, Karachiites are apathetic because there's suffering and death. Like, there'll be a suicide bombing in the afternoon, and then the evening, my friends will be like, hey, where are we going for dinner? And I'll be like, let's go to this restaurant. They're like, oh, the bombing happened there. It's closed. Let's go to this one. I'm like, all right, fine, let's go to that restaurant. And and a lot of people are like, how can you live like that? And we're like, what else are we supposed to do? And that's the Karachi response, is what else are we supposed to do? This is how we live, and we have to get by on a day-to-day basis. I remember when the Iraq War had first started in like 2003, and right after America's very successful invasion that we're all reaping the awards and bounties of now, there was that time where like Baghdad was just suicide bombings constantly, and Karachi at the time was still in its happy glorious phase that we briefly enjoyed for like 2 minutes, and everyone, I remember turning to like a friend and having this discussion saying, I don't understand how people in Baghdad live. They've got suicide bombings every day. What do you do? Do they not go to work? Like, do you just stay at home then? And then a few years later, I had the answer, which is, yeah, you just continue going to work. And if the bombing happened there, you take this route to the office and then you come home, and that's how you get by.
I'm actually astounded by your capacity for work, because you appear to be doing 2, 3, 4 jobs at once,
right.
And to go back to the really brutal bombing and the very solid memory you have of the man's lungs on fire, I think 4 or 5 days after that, you do a big show, a big comedy,
yeah. Yep.
And you call it the most honest show I've ever done. Why was it so honest?
I can't do just one job. Like, for me, my attention span doesn't allow that. So I need to do 2, 3 things at the same time. And I'd been doing stand-up comedy on the side for 2 years up until that point, while working as a journalist as well. And the thing that happened with that show was, it's a thing that we're all used to. Like, any performer in Karachi, if you're a musician or you're doing theater production or something, you know that until the show starts, there's no guarantee the show is going to start, because there'll be a suicide bombing, or there'll be a riot, or there'll be some drive-by shooting, or someone will get held up right outside the theater and the thing will have to be shifted to the next week, and ticket refunds are a standard process, and everyone knows what to do because it happens all the time. And I'd already like had 3 shows at this point, which had to be delayed several times in the last few years. And so then this show started. I had a show a week, 5 days after the bombing, and it was due to start 5 days after the bombing. It was a big stand-up comedy show. Like, tickets had been sold to hundreds of people, and it was going to be my new comedy hour that I was going to debut. And I'm standing there in the remains of the bombing, and I just got really angry, where I was like, I'm tired of delaying things. I'm tired of pushing my life around because this terrorism keeps intruding upon it. And I'm not going to let that happen anymore. And I got really angry and I said, I'm going to do the show anyway. And for a second, I was like, people might think I'm being callous, but I was like, I don't care. If they think I'm being callous, they won't come. And that's fair enough to them. But I'm not giving up on my comedy anymore. And so I went ahead and I did the show and everyone turned up. The audience backed out. And the laugh was a weird laugh. I read this thing once about New York post 9/11, where for the first week, no one was doing anything. And then like slowly comedy shows started coming back. And stand-up comedians would get up and they said that the laugh that you'd get wasn't like a standard laugh that you hear where you say something funny and people laugh. It was more like a desperate release of energy where it's like, I need to get this out so I can feel better about life. And that's the laugh that I got that night from everyone for the first 5 minutes. And I realized that I was actually doing something where we were all connecting on a level more than just, here's a joke, now you laugh. It was more of the, we're still alive, we're not going to let this bother us anymore. And I think that affected the way I see stand-up comedy, the way I do comedy, because up until then it was all like Seinfeldian observation, like, what's the deal with socks? But like now, after that, it became more political and angry and less commercially successful, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Look, I want to get to your not commercially successful News Weekly satire show as well.
Speaking of not commercially successful.
But look, before I get onto that, I loved the little story in the book about a Pakistani actor, Moeen Akhtar, who you saw when you were very, very young, yep. And how much that affected you. Why don't you tell us about
Moeen Akhtar, there's a reporter who asked me about comedy recently in Australia. I was being interviewed for a newspaper, and she said, what did you do in Pakistan? And I said, well, I was a comedian there. And she said, oh, I didn't realize there was comedy in Pakistan. And I had to explain. I was like, you understand, laughter isn't a Western construct. Like, you guys didn't come up with that. And people are always amazed when I tell them that comedy has a rich history in Pakistan. I have an Indian friend who once told me, he's like, in India we say, India got the music and Bollywood and Pakistan got the comedy. Because Pakistani comedians are renowned for their dark sense of humor, their extremely wicked sensibility. And Moeen Akhtar was one of the highlights of that. He was this incredible impressionist who could do any politician, any gender stereotype, any racial stereotype, anything, but wickedly clever and extremely subversive. And that was my introduction to comedy. Was I was at a family wedding, and comedians always end up having to, because comedy itself pays nothing, so we do crappy corporate gigs and things like that to make the money. And he'd clearly been doing that because he was at a family wedding performing to people who were just finished eating bowls of biryani. And he's on stage doing this joke. If I remember the joke correctly, it was basically how he tells a story as a musician. He's pretending to be a musician who's done an amazing song, and the audience keeps calling for an encore. And as the encores go on, the song stops being amazing, and it's just him weeping, begging for them to stop, and they're just going encore, encore, and just driving this musician to ruin because he can't stop singing. And the audience is in laughter, is in splits, and I was sitting in the front row, and I kept going, no more, you can stop. I got really worried for him. I was 6 years old. I was really worried about his safety. This poor guy is going to die if he keeps singing the song. And he kind of winked at me, and he's like, "This, it's okay. This is what I do. Relax. It's fun for everyone." And that's when I realized, oh my God, comedy is such a powerful thing. And I think that's the first interaction I had with comedy where it kind of made me realize why I wanted to do it so much.
Before I get onto your TV show, that sounds a bit like a one-man band, sort of John Oliver or John Stewart show. You're clearly, I know, I think you're very happy being both a comedian and a writer now, but you're clearly a real news junkie.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You're quite good at describing a self-confessed and someone who... I mean, I'm a news junkie. I've just managed to turn that into my job. You're really good at describing just that incredible, feverish working pace, and you're being a news junkie in a country that has no end of bad news.
Yep.
Just give people a bit of a description, because you're there when one of the TV news channels gets set up.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like being part of... Because that was a real explosion of the media in Pakistan.
Explosion is a terrible word to use in this case, but it is accurate. Look, we've got... I'm a news junkie. Everyone in Pakistan is a news junkie, by the way. My parents don't watch movies or sitcoms or anything. They just watch the news. In Australia, when something bad happens, the breaking news alert runs. In Pakistan, that breaking news alert doesn't go off. And I'm not even exaggerating. There's channels where 24 hours, breaking news, breaking news, breaking news. When the alert goes off means something's gone wrong because clearly the channel's been taken off the air. You know, like that's... And so, like, I was hired to join a group of people who were setting up a news channel in Pakistan in 2005. And we started work in 2005, and it was going to be, like, the first English-language news channel in the country. It was a really big deal. And we started setting it up. And I remember, like, while the channel was being set up is when Pakistan started beginning its slide downhill. And there was a riot in the city, and I turned to my news director and I was like, oh my God, it's a shame we're not on air as a channel right now because we're missing this riot. And he's like, this is Pakistan, there'll be tons more riots, like, don't worry about. And he was right, like, there has not been a shortage of those since then. I think the thing with me and news is my fascination with it is that it's information. And I can't not have many streams of information coming at me at the same time. And the news bulletin is the perfect encapsulation of that, right? In a half-hour news bulletin, you got world politics, local politics, entertainment news, weather, science, any breaking news there, anything like that. You get multiple genres of information assaulting you simultaneously. You absorb them all, and the ones that are more interesting or less interesting rise and fall accordingly. I think it's a fascinating way of tracking human development, civilization, and I can't get enough of it ever. Like, even in Australia, the first thing I did when I landed here was start watching the news because I knew that's how you learn about a country.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about your news satire show that seemed to consume an incredible amount of effort.
So News Weekly, it's spelled W-E-A-K-L-Y. That was my big pun. Nobody got it. Much like the book title over here, I Migrant, no one got that one either. It was basically the channel kept asking me that, like, we want you to do a news satire comedy show because they knew I liked doing comedy. And for the first 2 years, I refused to because I figured let them establish themselves as a news channel before we start making fun of the news. So once I felt we'd done that enough, then I decided to do the show. I'm a control freak in that it's not that I don't trust other people. I just think other people can't do it as well as I can. And so I started doing, the way I did it, I structured it was, a weekly news analysis and satire show, which was hosted, written, directed, edited, produced, and animated by me. The only thing I didn't do was the camera work because I couldn't remotely control the cameras. I did try, though, several times. And it was the happiest I've ever been. Like, I'd put the entire thing on air every Monday. I'd start working on Tuesdays, work all the way through to Sundays, shoot on Saturdays, shoot it on Saturday, edit it on Sunday, put it on air on Monday, and then begin the whole thing again. I got to do 27 episodes, and in those 27 episodes, I think I managed to piss off a lot of politicians, a lot of religious figures, half my newsroom, and it was definitely the happiest I've been in a very long time getting to do that. I made two big mistakes. One was I made fun of the news director's cousin. Not news director, the owner of the channel, like the people who put the money up, their relative was a ambassador, and I made fun of him in the news, and that didn't go over very well. And never bite the hand that feeds you. And then the other thing I did was I started focusing on international news as much as local news, and people weren't caring about that as much. And so, but it was fascinating to me. And so, yeah, that kind of killed the show, basically.
I want to get on a bit, I guess, to the way that you ended up in Australia. I think you're writing, so if we fast forward a little bit, you have a daughter.
Right.
And you start writing columns, and you attract the derision of being called a liberal fascist.
Yeah, that's a Pakistani thing.
Yes.
Liberal, like, I got very confused when I came to Australia, because liberal in Australia means conservative. But so I didn't realize, in the rest of the world, liberal means leftist, right? Liberal, leftist, right. Anyway, but that was the thing. In Pakistan, I started writing news columns because I needed to keep doing something to do with the news and politics and all that. So I started writing satirical editorial columns for the local newspaper. And my columns reflected my point of view, which is fairly leftist. Like, I'm just slightly very left of the Greens in Australia, I think, is how you'd find me. And I started writing these columns, and they were very big on how Pakistan should be more secular instead of religious, and how religious parties are ruining the country, and all those things. And the biggest crime in Pakistan right now is being a leftist, because you get called a liberal fascist. Which in and of itself doesn't make any sense, and it kind of reflects the fact that conservative people are generally not very bright, because even their insults are terrible. And what it means is basically that, oh, you're someone who wants the world to be very liberal in its outlook, and you want everyone to be liberal, so you must be a fascist, which reflects no understanding of liberalism or fascism. And they kept calling me that. And unfortunately, a lot of people who get called that also then get death threats and such. One of the other columnists who worked for the same newspaper, Raza Rumi, he was also a renowned liberal fascist, and then they tried to shoot him a few months ago, and now he's in hiding in America, I think. And so, it's one of those things where it's not a good thing to be called that, because the end results are fairly violent.
And give us a bit of an idea about why Australia. I mean, there's a good, great section in the book where you have an incredibly rich experience in America, but your wife studies here. Mm-hmm. How did you finally make the leap from Pakistan to Australia?
We looked around, basically. We would have stayed in Pakistan if it hadn't been for my daughter being born, basically. That's the one thing, like, we really... sometimes it gets tough. Being an immigrant is difficult, and living in Northam is very difficult. And sometimes it gets tough, and my wife says, this is your fault, we came here. And I'm like, well, no, technically we both agreed to come here because of my daughter. Like, just because I did the paperwork doesn't... Anyway. but the... The way it happens is that I had my daughter, and I looked around, and I was like, I don't want her growing up in Pakistan. I want her to grow up in a country where she has more rights, and her life is safer. And we started looking around at the different options, and America doesn't really encourage immigration as such. In fact, I think the only way to get into America right now is if you run across the border from Mexico. Canada had kind of clamped down heavily on immigrants recently. The economy was terrible. My friends who moved there, really rich friends, all of them are broke because none of them can get jobs. It'd been 3 years there. Australia, my wife had been here in 2006, and she'd been working. She did her master's degree from Melbourne. And I visited her in 2006 and spent a week with her, 2 weeks with her in Melbourne, and we fell in love with the city.
Almost got to Sydney. For a comedy festival.
Yes, that was in 2008, the Sydney Comedy Festival on Cockatoo Island. Mm. Happened, I think, only twice. I think I jinxed it. they called me the first year, and they said, we want you to come, and we've sold tickets, and it's going to be amazing and fantastic. And I got really excited. I was like, I'll get to go to Australia, and it'll be amazing. And then my visa got rejected at the last second. Because the Pakistani passport isn't so much a passport as it is a voucher for free rectal exams, like redeemable in airports around the world. And so we decided to look at Australia again. So in 2006, my wife had been here. She loved it. 2008, I almost got to visit, and I really wanted to try coming again. And so we figured, yeah, let's just do this. So in 2009, we began the immigration process. We filed the paperwork for work visas to come to Australia. And a quick 3 years later, it was processed.
Yeah. And look, just before I get on to Australia and where you're living now, the laughing armed bandit in, which I think that's in Karachi, just before you leave. Just explain that story, because that's quite an interesting story.
It's a story that is actually notorious in Karachi now, because some people just don't believe it happened, but it's true. Right. Everyone in Karachi gets held up at gunpoint. It's actually a rite of manhood, almost like a Maasai ritual or something, where you have to get held up at gunpoint, and if you haven't, then you're the one holding the gun. Like, that's actually a law there. And I'd been lucky, by the way. Like, everyone in my family had been held up. Everyone I knew had been held up at gunpoint. And a lot of people get shot and killed, and it's a very common thing. It's a very dangerous thing. And I was driving home from work a few weeks before we left for Australia, and I stopped at a traffic light, and there's a knock on the window. And just before I turned, I was like, yep, it's my turn. I turn around, I roll down the window, the guy's got a gun to my head, and he says, give me a phone, give me a wallet. And so I looked down, I followed the protocol, and I took out the phone wallet and I handed it over, and he took it from me, and then I do not know to this day why, but he took the phone and wallet and he said, I hope you're not angry with me. And I got really confused, and I kind of panicked, and when I panicked, my idiot comedy brain kicks in. So I turned around And I said, you've got my phone, you've got my wallet, leave me my anger. And it was a really strange thing because he started laughing. And then because he started laughing, I started laughing. And he's got a gun to my head this entire time, by the way. It's right here, we're both laughing. And then he stopped laughing. And so because he stopped laughing, I stopped laughing. And then he gave me the phone and wallet back. And I couldn't understand. I got really confused. I was like, I don't know what's happening. And I swear to God, he turned around and he, like, I even remember, like, he caressed the side of my face. And he said, I have to do this. This is what I do. I'm a thief. But if I don't do it, I get killed. But you're a good guy, and I'm not going to do this to a good guy. And I have a theory about what happened there, is that this is what he does. But it's always, the interaction is always thief-victim. But because I made a joke and we both laughed, it broke the facade for 5 seconds. And I think it stopped being thief-victim. It became just two guys laughing at a joke. And he couldn't bring himself to do that to another human being. It's only something he could do while the facade was up. And I believe comedy does that. I think it breaks the facade, which is why I think it's important. But I actually believe it saved my life that time, yeah.
And it's kind of provided a bit of an entree for you into Australian society, hasn't it? I'm interested in your life. I think it's an hour and 40 minutes out of Perth. You have to live there under the conditions.
Yes, it's
of
a
your
work
visa.
It says that we have to live in regional Western Australia for 2 years. And the joke I like doing is that it's it lets us live in Australia, but also makes us feel like we never left a third world country in the first place. And it's just, it's kind of slowly easing us into the system.
Your neighbors must love that joke.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I'm a hit in Northern with that joke. Yeah. But no, like we were actually looking around because we found out my lawyer very cleverly didn't tell us about the rules of the visa until we got the visa and he'd gotten his payment. Because we thought we'd just fly straight to Melbourne and settle in, but it turns out regional Western Australia. And so we started looking around and we saw this town called Mandurah, which is like an hour outside Perth, and its population is like, I think, 500,000 or something. And I was like, oh, 500,000 people, that's ridiculous, right? Like, how small is that? Because we're from Karachi, which is 23 million people. Like, I don't understand Australia. Like when I first came here, Australia's population is 22 million people, right? So I think it's less than Karachi. Mm. Like, when people say, fuck off, we're full, I thought you were being sarcastic for the longest time. And then... And then we looked at Mandurah and we're like, okay, fine, I guess we'll make do in Mandurah. And we reached Perth and there's no jobs in Mandurah at all because all the immigrants have the same idea. And so we ended up taking the first place that offered my wife, because she was the primary on the visa, it offered her a job, was Northam, which is a small town of 7,000 people, an hour and 40 minutes outside Perth. It's a small farming community, basically. And so that we've been living there for 2 years now. We've done our time in Northam now.
And look, I'll give everyone here a chance to ask a few questions. I've got a few of my own.
Yep.
It must be an interesting experience for you living through what the country's living through.
Yeah.
But, what's it been like? I mean, it's clearly you're an international citizen in terms of you've had college education and
right.
You know, English is a natural language for you, but you've also moved to a really, I mean, it's an incredibly remote place. What's it actually been like moving to Australia?
Well, it's a strange thing because I've moved to small town Australia, and small town Australia is very different from big city Australia. Like Northam is very different from Perth, which is very different from Melbourne, and so there's been like a lot of eye-opening experiences just in terms of getting used to the fact that small town life is so radically different, and you know, like I don't have to worry about being robbed or killed, but I do have to worry about a snake, you know. So like that's something that is really was an eye-opening thing for me. Australia overall, I think the best example I can come up with was I write columns like freelance. I still like doing that, and I wrote a column about the immigration minister's recent policies and my criticism of them. And I submitted it to a News Corp newspaper, a Murdoch-owned newspaper. And the editor came back and said, hey, why don't you submit this to Guardian? It would be more up their alley. I mean, you clearly are aligned with them politically. And I said, well, the thing is, like, if I publish in The Guardian, the people who read it are people who agree with me. If I publish it with you, the people who read it disagree with me, and therefore I get to change people's minds. And she said, look, here's the thing. We might not be able to publish it because we're not allowed to criticize the government. And I had to then write a long, impassioned plea saying that, look, if you want to pretend, I understand that this is the way you are, but if you want to pretend that you are unbiased, because that's an impression you want to create, publish my article because it'll make you look unbiased. And like this whole thing I had to pull just to get them to print my article. Which they did, though, to their credit.
Right.
But I don't understand it. Why is it so polarized? I don't understand any of that. In Pakistan, I could write my articles in a liberal newspaper or a conservative newspaper, leftist or rightist. It doesn't matter because they're newspapers. Their job is to report the news. Over here, where your economy is amazing, despite what every politicians tell you, because they're not economists, so what the hell do they know? And you have no problems. It's an amazing country. It really is an amazing country. Everything's fine. Why is it so polarized? Why does everyone hate each other? Why is it the left can only go there and the right can only go there? And I know where polarization leads because I've seen it in Pakistan, and that's the end result. And I don't understand why that's a path that you're so aggressively chasing after when the average person isn't like that. I do comedy in comedy clubs. Half the people in my crowd are liberal. Half of them are Labour, and half, you know, like the extra half are Greens. My math is as bad as anyone else's, but I should work on the budget. But they all also cross. The Greens guy is just as racist as the liberal guy, and the liberal guy is just as green about some issues as the Greens guy. That's what human beings are like. So the polarization makes no sense to me, and I don't understand why Australia is doing this silly thing to itself right now. It completely befuddles me, yeah.
Okay. Look, I do want to open up the two questions, and I'm sure if you don't ask questions about what's going on at the moment, I will. But before we get on to questions, I love reading. I actually need to tell you a little story. Sammy's publishers are great, like all publishers, at deluging, your average local ABC radio station. There's about 8 or 9 of these lying around. I just sort of thought, another book. Just didn't get to it. Like, it was quite literally on the path. And then my colleague Richard Stubbs interviewed Sammy, and I just wasn't aware of it at all. And I sort of come in the afternoon when Richard's finishing his show, and I think he'd just finished interviewing Sammy, and we do our little chat, blah, blah, and then the 3 o'clock news, how was the show, blah, blah. And Richard was like, oh, he was great. He was really funny. He's a great guy. You should really read this book. And I'm like, yeah, sure. Everyone tells me read a good book. Then I got approached, listen, do you want to have a chat to Sammy at the Wheeler Centre? I'm like, oh, yeah, sure, great, great. God, got to read the book. Fuck, Finally got onto it. Couldn't put it down. So just to let people thrust books into my hands all the time, telling me I should read them, and I go, yeah. I finally actually opened it up. It's fantastic. He's a really interesting person, and he's a wonderful writer.
Thank you.
So that is, this event quite literally fell into my lap. So reading the book was not something I was obliged to do in any way, and it's great. So I recommend it to you. But I'm sure you've got your own questions. Just stick up your hand, and please do wait for the microphone.
We've got a lady in the front here.
Yeah, go for it.
I live in country Australia.
Oh, really?
Oh, yep.
Victoria or?
South Australia.
Okay.
So I'm still there. Now, you've done your 2 years in the country.
Right.
So what are your plans? You're going to stay country or you're going to move into a city?
Well, we're there for a while still because we've applied for permanent residency, and then that takes a while to process. And I think it's a minimum 5 months for processing, a maximum of infinity. And I'm from Pakistan, so I'm probably going to be heading towards infinity then, 5 months into processing. Until the processing is done, you can't leave. So you have to continue staying there. So we're there for a while still. We have no clue when we're going to get to leave. When we do get to leave, however, the plan was we look at Perth, we look at other cities and see where the jobs are and where this is and that is. And I've been to Sydney for like 2-3 days. I've been to Adelaide. I've been to Brisbane. And then we came here. My wife is here as well, and my daughter. And we landed 2 days ago in Melbourne. It's the first time in Melbourne properly since we've come to Australia. And we're like, yeah, we're not going anywhere else. Melbourne's where we're going. So, yeah, it's fantastic. It's such a great city. It's silly of us to think otherwise. Yeah.
Anybody else? I'll ask you.
Yes.
Oh, there you go.
What do you miss?
The adrenaline rush of waking up in the morning and knowing you're still alive. I miss the food. Karachi has a very... It's one of the last undiscovered places for food. Like, Anthony Bourdain does that show on CNN where he goes to crazy places and discovers food no one else is eating because it's in these violent hotspots. And he's been everywhere. He hasn't been to Pakistan. And it's a shame because Pakistani food is very different from Indian food in that it's better. And... And the thing is, it's fantastic. It's delicious, and my parents are still back there, so I kind of miss my mom making food for me, which is just it's a city thing, but it is there. Other than that, you miss certain things, and then you read the news, and you're like, oh no, I don't miss them. Like, what's wrong with me? Like, it's like I miss the power going out, because in Karachi, electricity is not a guarantee. It's a promise often broken, and so we get like a few hours of the day every day. It's gone, and it's a thing. It's a routine where like, the light's gone, put on the candles, this and that, and you miss certain routines, and then you're like, what's wrong with me? That's like missing being tortured or something. So it's yeah, I miss things less and less, definitely.
I think there's another one in the front there. Yeah.
Sammy, you're right. We do live in an amazing country, and we're obviously now starting to become much more personally aware of, I suppose, terrorism and on the doorstep. And what I'm wondering is, when you're living confronted by death constantly and the prospect of your own death, do you start to value life less?
I think it's one of those things where you value other people's life less, but I also think that everyone values other people's life less. I like everyone loves to say all life is precious. That's something we all love to say, all life is precious, but it really is just my and my friends and family's lives are precious, and everyone else isn't as important. Because if you think about it, right now there are people dying everywhere, and we, you know, I mean, it's not getting in our way as much. It's just the way it is that there is in Pakistan. If I stop to start thinking about how miserable other people's life is, I won't be able to function. And that was a big problem for me for a long time, where in Karachi homeless children are a very big, a very constant feature, where every traffic light, the car is confronted by like lots of homeless children, and you start giving them money, and then you realize if I give them money, then the money is being taken by a mafia that controls them, and they don't actually get it, so you give them food instead. And then you start thinking, all right, maybe if I adopt these 10 kids and pay for their education and their life, and next thing you know, you've given away all your money, and your life is finished and broke because you've dedicated yourself to them, but you've got nothing left to give now. And I know many people who that's happened to, and I could feel it starting to happen to me. And so we left, and it was a very cowardly thing that I've done. If now that I know that I should have stayed and helped, but I instead ran away because my life is precious to me, more precious than anyone else's. And similarly, I think everyone here goes to Bali, and there's misery in Bali that you don't see because it's outside the bus window on the way to the hotel. And it's the same in around the world. So I think to say that life is more precious or less precious in certain places isn't true. I think it's equally non-precious everywhere in the world, except your own life. I have a very cynical approach to that, but it's kind of based on what I've seen, if you will. But I do want to take one thing that you said, which was the terrorism on Australia's doorstep. Did you guys have a terrorist attack and no one told me? Because, did 9/11 happen here and did they forget to mention it in the news? Like, what happened? There's been nothing. 20 people were arrested by 600 policemen, which that's a lot of policemen for those 20 people, out of which 19 were let go the next day.
That's right.
But that story never got followed up. So one guy got finally prosecuted for illegal firearm possession, which
charged,
is a lot,
not prosecuted.
Charged, not prosecuted, yeah. Which is a lot different from trying to cut someone's head off. One mentally ill kid got shot, which is, you know, he had flags and stuff. I don't know about that story yet, but nothing's happened, right? So like America went nuts after 9/11. England went kind of nuts after 7/7. Australia went nuts because it was a Tuesday. Like, what happened to cause this? I don't understand it. And I mean, like, it's one of those things where, like, a month ago, I was joking in a stand-up show where I said, Tony Abbott's ratings are so bad, he's going to fake a terrorist attack to raise them. And then a month later, I was like, wow, I guess I am prophetic. Like, that's, I should charge for this shit. Like, that's really, it's a bizarre thing. I don't understand it at all. It's fine here. Everything's fine. And you're actually now actively guaranteeing something will happen with the current path. It's a weird thing where it's not at the doorstep. It's many doorsteps away, and you're waving for it to come across. Like, it doesn't make sense to me. Sorry.
Wow. Another question. Just the one down the back there.
Sammy, yeah, you're talking a lot about the violence back in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. What are some of the ordinary things about being Pakistani that you miss, you know, family and things like that?
I mean, it's one thing that you, it's not like I'll ever stop being Pakistani. I was born in Pakistan, I spent 90% of my life there, and technically I'm still not an Australian either. I'm still a Pakistani on a temporary resident visa. So I'll always carry some things with me. I'll carry, for me, the most powerful thing about Pakistan, which not many people get to appreciate or get a chance to appreciate, is the music. We've got an amazing, vibrant music scene. And that's something that I carry everywhere. It's in my pocket. It's in my headphones. And it's the songs that I hear that the soundtrack to my life are Pakistani songs. So for me, like, that's a really important thing that I don't get to be a part of anymore, because I'm not there to find out the latest new songs. I hear about them now once they become bigger. Other than that, I think it's probably just... I don't know. I think, like, it's a weird thing because it's also where I am. I'm in Northam, which is a small town. I miss the hustle bustle of a big city. So that's not just specific to Karachi. That's just being specific to being a person who grew up in cities. I'm sure if I lived in Melbourne or Perth or someplace, well, maybe not Perth, but if I lived in Melbourne, I'd miss that less, because that would be a more of a constant feature. Like, I walk around now and it feels like home to me, because there's people everywhere bumping into you and everyone's angry that you're stopping in the middle of the road. I heard, like, car horns the other day. I haven't heard car horns in 2 years, I realized. No one honks in WA, right? Like, and I heard someone, like, angrily bleating the horn here, and I was like, oh, that feels so good. Like, that is nice. So, yeah, you miss the weird things.
And just, is there anyone born in Pakistan who perhaps has Pakistani parents in Northam?
Pakistani parents in Northam?
Well, I just wonder, is there anyone with any sort of Pakistani connections where you're living now?
Not that I know.
Not at all.
Not
so you're the one Pakistani.
No,
the
but there's a Malaysian family in town that have been there for like a few years now, and they have a really good restaurant in town. They're doing and they're wonderful. We recently, in the last few weeks, actually, an Indian family moved into town. And like, I saw them walking, and I was like, what are they doing here? Like, this is my town. Like, this is, it was like a, hey, like, hey, I'm the brown guy. Like, no, like, it was like a weird, like, territorial thing. So, okay. Yeah.
War on the streets of Northern. Yeah. There's another question there.
Sammy, what prompted getting into stand-up comedy? And if you'd come to Australia, say, 10 years ago, do you think you would have got into stand-up comedy?
I don't think stand-up comedy is something you choose to do. I think it's a compulsion. Because the people I've seen who do stand-up comedy, now that I'm in Australia as well, I know many other comedians, they're all from all backgrounds. They're a variety of people with different lives and such. And I think it's just something that there's certain people who have that blend of narcissism and self-doubt and deep-seated insecurities and a need for like public appreciation. Like, I'm... Like, this is more comfortable for me than a one-on-one conversation, you know, because I'm happier with an audience, and that's any stand-up comedian is only happy in certain environments. So I don't think it's a compulsion. I think I don't think it was a choice. I think it's something I would have done regardless of where I was, absolutely.
You talk about the polarization of political views. Do you reckon comedy helps center, like, everyone's view, just because, I don't know, it shows the absurdity of both sides, of being so fundamentalist, like, either way sort of things, like, by being so liberal or so left or so right?
Well,
so comedy just...
A lot of comedians, most comedians are actually, like, left, tend to be leftist. That's just a general thing. I was doing a thing for ABC Radio in Perth for a while where on drive time I'd make fun of just the local stories on a weekly basis. It's like a 10-minute segment, and I'd just round up the local stories and do jokes about them. And they, after the government changed, after the last election, they called me up and they said, hey, we're not allowed to do your show anymore unless we get a conservative comedian to balance you off. Is there a conservative comedian? Andrew Bolt was the only one I could think of, but I actually don't think that there's a thing as a conservative comedian, because comedians generally tend to be leftist. It's just a thing. I don't know why, but it is. And how? So you're not going to get balance. Like, if you're looking at comedy for balance, you're not going to find it, because comedians tend to just make fun of the things they know of to make fun of. Now, for example, I'm very leftist. So for me, even the Labour Party is conservative, right? So, like, if someone comes at me and says, you only make fun of the Liberals, that's not true, because I make fun of the Labour Party as well. I was doing jokes about them when they were in power, and now I'm doing jokes about Liberals because they're in power. And so that's how it is. But at the same time, for me to deny the fact that I have a leftist bias, that if you say climate change isn't happening, I will make fun of you. Like, that's, I can't say that, to be honest. And I don't think most comedians can say that.
One more question, I think.
Second turn,
go.
Sorry.
Go for it. Second bite of the apple.
I think it's a question.
Mm-hmm.
We live in a country where things are pretty easy. We don't have to work really hard to get by. And I often wonder, when people are always confronted with maybe their own mortality, do you have more sense of your... is life got more meaning? I think a lot of people are depressed, really. You know, we have an easy life, and a lot of people seem to be like, oh, well, you know, they don't seem to have an under... You know, sort of... Do you understand what I'm asking?
I get what you're asking.
When,
I think
when life's pressured,
right,
like you're talking about, do people stop thinking about their own, themselves and just get on with it and somehow enjoy life more?
I think it's yes. You party harder, but I genuinely mean that, in not just in the like going to parties, but in the philosophical sense of party harder, where like in Karachi. Like when journalists come to Pakistan, they always like they'll cover the thing. Like, there's a bomb blast in the morning, and people are dancing at night, and the people who are dancing at night are clearly callous and cruel, whereas though they're dancing against the darkness almost. But at the same time, I think that's what we're aspiring towards. When you're in a place where things are bad and everyone's life is at risk constantly, what you're aspiring towards is to be a place where nothing's bad and everyone's life is happy and constant pleasant. To not worry about your personal safety on an hourly basis is a luxury and a comfort that is worth aspiring towards. So I would, you know, would I give up that really crazy party attitude where it's basically I must be happy because otherwise I'll die tomorrow? Would I give it up for more of a pleasant, like modulated ennui? Then yes, I definitely would, because I think this one is too extreme and results in extremes of emotion, whereas this one's more balanced. And it's something that is you can take for granted. I want to be able to take safety for granted. That's what I enjoy now. I'm so paranoid still. I've got a webcam set up in my home in Northam, which beams to my phone. Because I'm paranoid about break-ins. Because I'm still from Karachi. You leave your house and someone's going to break into your house. So I can check on my house still. But no one else in Northam does that. Because they're not idiots. They know no one's going to break in. So I want to be able to do that. I want to be able to... It's okay. No one's going to break in.
Okay. Thank you all for your questions. Sammy will be at the back if you want to grab a copy of the book. And you can ask him another question. Get him to sign a copy of the book. I'd like to thank the Wheeler Centre for inviting Sammy and I. Like to thank Alan and Unwin, the people who published the book, and there's quite a few people here at the Wheeler Centre as well who helped put the whole event together. So as we applaud, let's remember them and thank Sammy for coming along.
Thank you.